We're going to talk about the whirlwind, which is a time when we think represents the culmination of your hopes in glory. We're living at that time today when that whirlwind experience that took Elijah into glory is approaching. Now, to review a little bit, in 2 Kings, the second chapter, this is where we find the passage that really introduces the whirlwind experience. And it says in verse 1, 2 Kings 2, verse 1, "And it came to pass when the Lord would take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal." And you know the story. We won't read all the 11 verses that incorporate the story, but you know the narrative. You know that they went from city to city to city. And every time they went from one place to another, everybody seemed to know that Elijah was going to be taken. Now, this is rather mysterious. I don't know how they knew. But they went from Gilgal to Jericho, Gilgal to Bethel, Bethel down to Jericho, Jericho down to the Jordan. And every time they found a school of the prophets. Now, what Elijah was doing here was visiting the schools of the prophets that he had fostered by his influence and bidding them, I think, a last exhortation, a farewell. And so everywhere he went, the people would say to Elisha, the servant of Elijah, "You know, your master's going to be taken today." He said, yeah, I know. Now, this is incredible. How did they all know? But they seem to know. And I think we're in that period of history today when everybody out there in the Christian world seems to know that we're at the time when the Lord's going to take his church home soon. Now, not everybody out there in the Christian world has the same, may I say, clarity of understanding of the end times that we're privileged to have because we've been instructed, you know, by the seventh messenger. And so we know that actually the saints have been raised from the Lord's return forward, and that those who die in the Lord now are caught up to be with Christ immediately. But we also realize there's more saints to go. And this leads to the question, are we just going to die out one by one? And then maybe the last remaining saint will go and finally the kingdom will come. I don't think it's going to work that way. Now, sometimes we think, well, you know, the numbers of brethren are diminishing and therefore there's just going to kind of continue to diminish. But you know, that's not everywhere that's happening. In India, for example, the number of brethren are increasing. Now, Ruth and I went to India in 1998, was it? And we attended a large convention, and now they have multiple conventions of that size, and things are expanding. Now, I just got an email from a brother in Chennai. He's got a problem. They've been doing, that's a nice problem. They've been doing witness work, and they have a year program of study, and then after a year, they offer the participants who finish the course baptism. Now, I happened to have the privilege to go there in January of last year, and I was at one of their conventions, and one morning they said, "Get up early in the morning, we're going out for baptism," and 25 people or so were baptized. Now, the letter he wrote, emailed me, he says, "We've got now 6 new ecclesias, and the problem is they want me to be their elder." He's talking about himself. He says, "Is that right for me to be elder at all these places?" And I wrote back and said, "You know, that's a very nice problem to have." And I said, "If that's what they want, your influence, I would encourage you to do that. And also encourage others to, you know, locally pick up the thread of leading and so forth." In Africa, it's not as dynamic, but it is still increasing. Now, I don't know about Romania. I hear mixed reports, increasing or not. But there's a lot of brethren in Poland. There's diminishing brethren in the Western countries. That is true, the diminishing numbers. But how long do you think we have left? Now, some years ago, I was in communication with Brother A.O. Hudson of England. Most of you brethren know who that would have been, even if you never met him. My father had the privilege of meeting him. I did not. I went to England with the expectation that I would, but his wife was very ill. And so I had some communication by mail, not email in those days, but by mail. And I asked him some questions, and he answered my question with a nice letter. And then at the end of his letter, he added, unrequested, a little story about how things were in his day. Now, he died at almost the age of 100, about the year 2000. Tim, you might know more precisely, but somewhere around there. And so he goes way back. He was a young lad of 14 years old or so, when the brethren were expecting the church to be complete in 1914. Now, if you knew about Brother Hudson, you know he was a precocious, he must have been as a child a precocious child. But he was 14 years old, and he asked the brethren in England, well, suppose it doesn't happen. And they said, oh, it will happen. But it didn't. And then he said, but it will. I give it 25 years. That was an unsolicited comment of his prognostication. Didn't have any, you know, particular point except his observation. Well, now here we are some years later. Now, some of you know I have an opinion about when the church might be complete. We're going to refer to that today. I think we've got 25 years to go again. So I remember what Brother Hudson said. Well, we'll see how that works out. But we're going to look about evidences that show us the approaching time when we might be taken. And I think that it's not going to be, in my opinion, fading out to the end until one is left and then he's gone. I think the whirlwind experience tells us something different is in store for the last remnant of the church. And we're in that period of history generally. All the Christian world seems to know. Now, exactly how will the Lord intervene to accomplish this? I don't know. I don't even have an opinion on that one. A lot of opinions, you know, contrast with the things you know. But in this one, I don't know how it's going to happen. But I do think that there's going to be an intervention that does take the church home, as opposed to, for instance, Enoch, who was just taken quietly. Elijah is taken with great commotion, in great expectation, which I think pictures the end of the harvest of the gospel age. Now, if we look back to 1 Kings, the 17th and the 18th chapters going on, there's a long narrative from chapter 17 through 1 Kings chapter 22 that is relevant to this. Now, you know the narrative. The narrative is that there was the apostasy of Ahab with his evil wife Jezebel, who was not even an Israelite. You know, things had been pretty bad in Israel from the time Jeroboam set up two golden calves to worship Jehovah in the form of an idol. But now the scriptures say when the time of Ahab came, because of the influence of his wife Jezebel, not only were they worshiping Jehovah under the form of an idol, but now for the first time, they introduced a different pagan god into their worship, and that was Baal. Things got really bad, and Elijah stepped forward, and he knew by the Spirit of God that the warnings back in the law of Moses were, it was timely for that, when he said, I'll withhold rain from you. And so Elijah stepped forward as a prophet and said, there will not be rain nor dew these years except by my word, because of this depth of apostasy. And we all seem to think, and I think you're right, and it's in volume 3, that 3.5 years of drought pictures the period from 539 to 1799, 1260 years, where there was a drought for spiritual things in a very measurable way. But after that, the rains came intensely. Now, when Elijah was rescued, when Elijah appeared at the end of that 3.5 years, and he caused rain to come again, first there was a confrontation with the priest of Baal, and they were all destroyed. They were put out. And I think that this represents a confrontation as the 1260 years began to close, and that we saw that in the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, that papacy was put down. Now, papacy declared that you had to be a member of our church to be saved. That's their view of the atonement. The Protestant section said, no, that's not right. And so there's two views of the atonement, and by the fall and collapse of the Catholic Church, so much that the Pope died as a prisoner of Napoleon, and they would not allow the election of a successor for a brief time. That view of the atonement can't be right. You got to be a member of a church that's collapsed? No, the Protestant view was successful, and I think that's what that whole confrontation was about. But after that, there was going to be a great rain, and he told his servant to go out and look for that cloud. He saw a cloud like the hand size of a man's fist. He says, okay, you better run back to the palace. We're going to have a deluge. And that represents the rain that came from the translation, the publication of the scriptures into the vernacular of the people by the millions and the millions. And that set a stage for the end of the age that even blesses us to this day. I can't imagine a time, not in my lifetime, when we didn't have free access to Bibles by any amount, number that you wanted, and for very low cost. But we have that today because of that reign of truth that has come after that time. Well, after that, Ahab and Jezebel threatened Elijah again, and he had to flee. So Elijah fled into the wilderness, and there he was so discouraged, he was ready to say, just take my life, I'm no better than my forebears. And boy, he was discouraged. Have you ever been that discouraged? Well, maybe. Life has a lot of experiences. So just remember, Elijah, you're not alone in discouraging experiences if those things come to you. But Elijah, God knew what Elijah needed. A little rest, a little food, a little water. And so actually he sent an angel to refresh Elijah twice. And there were two angels. And I think that represents in the feeding of Elijah there miraculously. I think that represents the two feedings of the church by the Adventist movement in the early 1800s. And also then the second feeding, I think that was the feeding that we have received of present truth from the Lord's return forward from 1874. And he went in the strength of that food for 40 days unto Mount Horeb. And at Mount Horeb, he saw a vision of the time of trouble in three stages. I think that 40 days represents from 1874 to 1914 when the time of trouble would be unleashed in three broad stages. Now, the brethren were looking at the unleashing of trouble to be perhaps the time when the church would be complete. Well, it didn't happen that way. The trouble did start, but it's three broad stages instead of just a short period of time. Now, here's something from Volume 3 in the foreword written in 1916, if we've got it here. Here it is. We anticipate that before a very long time, perhaps a year or two or three, the full number of the elect will be completed and all will have gone beyond the veil and the door will be shut. It didn't happen, but it will, as Brother Hudson would say. What's the problem? Problem is not the history of prophecy that has brought us to our day. That's on track. The problem is that the time of trouble has been extended. Now, when Elijah saw a vision of the time of trouble, you remember, it was the wind, and then the earthquake, and then the fire. Now, maybe we thought the winds of war would climax the whole thing, lead to a social unrest, and the kingdom would come quick. As of 1916, he still thought so. Now, there's a reprint article, 5950, where he looks forward to maybe 1918 would be a marker of some sort, because that would be 1845 years from the end of the Jewish revolt at Masada. Oh, that was an interesting possibility. Did anything happen in 1918? Yeah, that was the end of World War I. And I think that 4 years from 69 to 73, way back in the end of the Jewish age, does picture World War I in 1914 to 1918. But there was going to be another world war. We didn't know about that. And I think the winds that Elijah saw are a figure of the two world wars. Now, when did they end? 1945. And then the next part of the trouble is going to be the earthquake. That is a breakup of the old colonial powers that have ruled the world so much that were broken apart in World War II. And what happened after World War II? Israel in 1948 became free. A year before that, in 1947, India, a major bloc of the British Empire, got their independence. And then in the 60s, much of Black Africa did. And then in the 70s, much of Indochina. And finally, it was capped off in 1989, I will suggest to you, by the breakup of the last remaining large empire that had captive countries as satellite, unwilling satellites, and that was the Soviet Union. Now, I was surprised when that happened. Most brethren that I spoke to that are interested in prophecy were surprised. Now, I know one brother that said, I expected it. Now, okay, I give him credit. I only know of one brother. Maybe he knows of others. But I was surprised. But in retrospect, it seemed to us that this was the end of another period of Elijah's vision of the time of trouble. So these are not quick periods of time. These are decade-long periods. And now we're in the third period. That's the fire phase. Now, we always thought fire might be, you know, brief anarchy. Well, again, readjust the concept of brief here. I think it's decades long, and I think it's the fire of Islamic insurgency. Shortly after 1989, we got involved in Gulf War number one. Then we had 9/11, then we had Gulf War number two, then we had the supposed Arab Spring that turned out to be more like an Arab nightmare, and then we still got the problem in Syria with the current war, And all of this, we can cite scriptures in Isaiah that fit to these experiences, but we've got more. And I don't think this is going to end until the kingdom comes. Now, I think in 2 Kings chapter 3, you have a picture of a rebellion by Moab that does picture the Islamic peoples. And that takes us right into the kingdom. I won't go into detail on that, just to tell you that there is something here that I think shows us the fire of Islam is still going to be active until the kingdom and take us right into it. So we've got another phase to go to. Now, how long are these phases? Well, let's look at a little chart here. They're 1799 until the expectation that the Adventists had that peaked in 1843. Now, they had to change it 1 year after that didn't happen, but after that they gave up on their expectation. 44 years, and then another 31 years would transpire before the end of the 1335 days as we apprehend it, that takes us to the Lord's return in 1874. And then Elijah was fed that second time. He went for 40 days until 1914, and he saw a picture of the winds and then the earthquake. And if we have those dates right, from 1914 to 1945, that's the period of the winds, plural. And may I say in Daniel, the second chapter, when the image is smitten, the winds carry away the pieces. Winds, plural. And in Acts 27, I think when they sailed through two seas of wind, we have a picture of two World Wars II. So that ends in 1945. I mean, historically, it just did. That's the end of World War II. And then you go forward to 1989, you got 44 years. Now, you see a little symmetry there. You can't miss the symmetry. Is that meaningful or is that just fortuitous? Well, you make your decision on that. I think it's meaningful. But you know what? I'm always partial to looking for something like that. So I think there's meaning there. But what that tells us is that we're on track. Instead of these periods of time being brief periods, they're decades-long periods. So let's see. The first period of the time of trouble was more than three decades. The second period, a little more than four decades. Is it possible that the third period might be a little more than five decades? Well, I think so. But at least we're somewhere in the order of magnitude in the right area. Now, what else can we see in Scripture that we might see kind of points to our time and let us know in some rough way how much time we have left? Well, there's a couple. One are the plagues in Revelation. Now, you've heard talks on the plagues before. Some have different views about what, but today it seems to me that most of the brethren kind of seem to be seeing, that study this area, that the plagues are progressive over a long period of time. Now, you know what the very last plague in Revelation of the seven plagues is? It uses the word Armageddon. Okay, in the sixth plague, he gathers the kings of the earth to the battle of the great day, and he gathered them to a place called in the Hebrew tongue the hill of Megiddo. This is where Armageddon comes from. So presumably when he pours out the seventh vial, that is Armageddon that proceeds. Now, I don't think that you and I are going to be here when that happens. Now, I do, it's true that the great company is going to lapse into that time. But the elect, the bride class, and you hope to be of the bride class, I'm still hoping to be of that class. Let's hope we're faithful. And if that case, I think we won't be here when Armageddon is unleashed. The great company, I think, will be. You know the scripture in Jeremiah 8:20 that is often used for the great company? The harvest is past. The summer is ended. We're not saved. We're still here. You know what Jesus said in Matthew 24:20? Pray that your flight be not in the winter, because you've missed the opportunity for the bride class in the summer. And what is it that, if that's true, that's very prophetic, it's a very common application, I think it's correct. But if it is true, what is it going to be that tells the great company something's wrong here? I think because they're going to see things that they didn't expect to see. For example, Israel besieged by Gog and Magog from the north. And as Micah 5:5 says, when that happens, when the Assyrian treads our palaces, then we're going to raise by prayer against him seven kings, they're termed shepherds. That's a idiom for rulers. Seven kings and eight princes. There's the intervention of the church and the great company. The church and the ancient worthies. If they see the ancient worthies or people who claim to be people like that, leading Israel to victory, they might think, I didn't think I'd see that here. Now, who are these people? Ancient, who are these? And I think maybe that's going to alert them. Something's wrong here. And the great company will have an opportunity to pass through some final experiences. Where are we in the series of the plagues? How far are we? I suggest that we have seen five of them already come and go. I won't go through all of them. If you ever hear Jim Parkinson talk on that, I think he's just about right. So I agree with his sequence. But the fifth one, what is the fifth plague? The fifth plague is on the seat of the beast. That's papacy. Did we see papacy undergo some dynamic, difficult experience in recent decades? We did. After World War II, we saw the communist doctrines and the communist armies come westward into the core of what was the strength of papacy's domain, and that was Middle and Eastern Europe. Now, I had a young gentleman from Poland used to work for the place we worked for, and he helped us do a little translation for the International Convention once. And he brought his Bible, and out of the Bible plopped a picture of good old Pope. You know, I mean, that's when you're in Poland, you know, unless you're a Bible student, I think, or an atheist, you're going to be Catholic. And yet that was overrun. And so is Hungary, a strong Catholic country. And in Romania, you've got, I know, the Orthodox Church, but Catholics are still there. But that was the stronghold of the old thinking that was overrun. And now what happened with the fall of the Soviet Empire is the strong Western wind of Western culture and military ability pushed back on that, and that threat is gone. And I think that matches what you see in Exodus. In Exodus, the corresponding plague, because there were 10 there, that would be plague number 8. Plague number 8 was these locusts that came from an east wind, came into the land of Egypt, ate up every green thing, and then a strong western wind pushed those locusts back out, and that plague was ended. I think that's what we saw in 1989, the end of plague 5. What is plague 6? Well, for one thing, it is the only plague intervening that we are still looking for before you're going to be in glory, because I hope we're not here when the seventh plague is unleashed. What is plague 6? Well, it says it's the drying up of the river Euphrates. What was the Euphrates? That was what brought commerce and life to Babylon. That's why they were an empire, because he had the Euphrates bring in commerce and trade, economy. Is it possible that in the Western world, the economies will suffer a severe blow that will be that plague? I think so. Now, others have thought that before me when I was skeptical, but I think that they're right. I think that's the next looming problem. Now, if you want to get some details about finances, don't ask me. Ask Len Grice, somebody else. But I think it matches the prophecy. I think that's the next debacle. Now, when 2000 came and the dot-com bust came, caught my attention, market went way down, came back. In 2008, when the housing boom, you know, went bust, that caught my attention. Went it even farther down. Now it's come back and then farther back. But if you look on the internet, you can always find anything you want, I know. But there are plenty of warnings there about the heavy, heavy debt burdens of the Western economies. We will see. But I think that's the next plague. When is it going to hit? 11 years from now. We'll see. We'll see. I'll tell you why I think that a little bit later. We'll see. We are talking things we don't know for sure. So those are two evidences that I think tell us that we're about on track and give us an order of magnitude when things are going to come to pass. But there's something more. Now, this is going to take us into another area that has been controversial. And you may not believe this, but I really don't like to talk on controversies. I really don't like to stir things up. But I do like to say things that I think are scriptural that might clarify some things. So be patient with me here. Be patient. But I'm going to go into the book of Ezekiel, and through our discourse, we're going to also cite a number of things that Pastor Russell has written that I think have been too long ignored. By me, they were at one time. And maybe if we focus on those things, it also can help us straighten out our idea of what is coming and perhaps when. Well, we'll see. Just we'll hold that in abeyance. Let's go to Ezekiel, the 46th chapter, if you would turn with me there. Ezekiel 46 is part of a very long dissertation by Ezekiel, a long vision of 8 or 9 chapters, that almost all the brethren say, this is a picture of God's kingdom when it is fully established. Now, I'm of the opinion that Jesus has returned as king, and in a sense, we already see the power of the kingdom. Somebody during the convention used the expression in our fellowship, when the kingdom is fully established. And I agree with that distinction. You remember in Luke 19, where Jesus was approaching Jerusalem for one of his last times, and the disciples thought, okay, this is going to be the time when he's going to come into Jerusalem and take the kingdom. And Jesus realized their expectations were not quite right. So he paused and he gave them a parable about a king, about a man who was going to go into a far country to receive a kingdom and then to return. And when he returns, having received the kingdom, and I think that's where we are today. I think Christ has returned. He's got the power and authority of the kingdom. A number of scriptures we could cite on that, but we won't because of time consideration. But we haven't yet seen the kingdom of God established on the earth. We see Israel. We see that top of the mountains. We see something coming, but it's not yet fully established, and they don't recognize their Messiah yet. So let's go to Ezekiel 46, verse 1, and see if there's any light to shed on this question. Ezekiel 46, verse 1. Thus saith the Lord God, the gate of the inner court that looketh toward the east shall be shut the 6 working days. But on the Sabbath it shall be opened, and in the day of the new moon it shall be opened. Now this is a gate that's going to allow people access to the temple where God is, where they're going to be able to worship the Heavenly Father. Now if you look elsewhere in Ezekiel, it says when the people do come up to worship God, they're going to, the temple is going to be elevated. They're going to have to climb some stairs. They're going to have to climb a series of 7 steps and then a clear series of 8 steps to get there. Kind of reminds you of the 7 stages of the church. The church will be there to help mankind. And then the 8 princes, the ancient worthies, that'll be the vehicles to lift mankind back to God. So this kingdom is telling us those gates that allow people to go in that direction and worship God are going to be closed for 6 working days. But on the 7th day, they're going to be wide open. Now ask yourself this question. Today, in 2018, are those gates closed or are they open? And I think there's only one answer to that question. Those gates are closed today. Well, if they are, then which of these days are we on? Are we on the 6 working days or on the Sabbath when it's going to be opened? That all by itself would lead you to the conclusion, but there's other evidences to consider. But at least this part of it would tell us we're still in the 6 working days. Now, you already know where I'm going with this. And that is that these days represent 1,000-year periods in God's plan. So here is my suggestion. We see the prophecies pointing to the harvest for the 1260, 1290, 1335 days in 1874. We see the 40 years taking us to the time of trouble. We see the time of trouble unleashing. We see our king in charge having smitten that image. And in my opinion, that image is gone. We don't see today in Europe being ruled by church-state policy. I think that image is gone. So we're advanced in this area. But in my opinion, a suggestion, the reason why the kingdom has not yet come is because we have not yet reached that day in which the gates are going to be opened. In other words, if those gates are closed today, which by all accounts they must be, for the world to approach God, we're still on the 6 working days. And those days are not yet over. Now, I think those days are 1,000-year periods. So, now you catch a glimpse for how one might prognosticate when the kingdom would come. Is it possible that though the Lord has returned and all these things are in place, that the key to the extended time is simply that the 6 days have not yet ended? Now, you know in Psalms 90, verse 4, 1,000 years are in thy sight as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Have we ended 6,000 years? That would be the question. Now, you know my opinion on that just because we're in a fellowship and you know a lot about what people think. But I want to get something. I want to go back to how Brother Russell calculated this time and get a little history here of the basis for the count of years that we often use. Now, in volume two, what Brother Russell does is he takes a generally accepted date, and then he counts back from there through the scriptures to Adam. Sounds like a very reasonable thing to do. But there's something you may have missed in volume two, and that's on page 36, when he says, and we'll quote his exact words, and for emphasis, he underlines this with italics, quote, "The earliest definite time for the dating of events was established in Babylon, the era of Nabonassar, 747 BC. Now, that's been right there in volume two all these years, but we haven't used it. He used a different date for a starting date. And the starting date that he used as one generally accepted by historians in his day, today is not. The date that he used as the generally accepted starting point, today is not the date used in general historical work for the opening of Cyrus's reign. But this date, 747 BC, which he cited in volume two, is. Now, how much back farther can we go for a generally accepted date today that we couldn't 200 years ago when the foundational thoughts for volume two were first laid? How much work has there been to establish a very positive date back in antiquity that we could start with? Well, if you have an NIV study Bible and you look at 1 Kings 6:1, you will find a date that today is generally agreed to be historically sound and scripturally sound by those who actually believe in the record of Kings and Chronicles. Now, if you look at that in the margin, if you have an NIV, you'll see a note. It says 966 BC. Now, I'm not going to get into great detail on that, but I would like to cite what Brother Russell might have said about that date if he was living today. Well, how can we possibly know that? Well, because that date depends upon the evidence in the books of Kings and Chronicles, and he commented on that evidence. You'll find this in the question book on page 42. At the end of a question, he's talking about all these scriptures in Kings and Chronicles that take you to history way back to the days of Solomon. And he says, we don't understand how this information integrates. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. We just don't understand. Perhaps someday we will. I think if he was living today, he would say, oh, now we do. And it is generally recognized by those that believe the Bible and give attention to these details that we can calculate back through scriptures with united testimony of scripture and history as far back as 966 BC for the foundation of Solomon's temple. Now, without going into more detail on that, let me summarize the whole point. If you do that, and then if you just simply say, we're going to count the years from the Old Testament from Adam to the Solomon's temple, then you will get a result. And that result is the kingdom will be here in about 25 years from now. Now, I'm not going to tell you the date. No, people don't like dates. I can tell that. So I'm going to not tell you that you already know what date I think it is anyway. But it's 25 years, I think, is a good approximation for when this period of time is going to fill. To come full. Now, with that in mind, we'd like to look at a little more evidence from Ezekiel chapter 46, verse 1, that might give further support to this concept. And that is, it says here, there's two things that are going to point to the kingdom. One is that it's going to be the seventh day. Now, if you ask me, are we yet in the seventh day? My answer is yes. For the church. Because the consecration of the priesthood during the gospel age takes 7 days, and we're in the seventh period. We're in that seventh day. But for the world of mankind, in my opinion, we're not yet. And I think that's why the gates are still shut. But notice the other side of this question. And in the day of the new moon, it shall be opened. In the day of the new moon. Now, if you go through Ezekiel 46, you'll see there's different metaphors, different symbolisms, one for the whole world of mankind and one with a view to Israel. So with respect to Adam and his race, this says the kingdom is the seventh millennium. That's the way I read this text interpretively. With respect to the flip side on Israel, it says that the kingdom's going to be after, well, on the day of the new moon, then the gates are going to be opened. What is the day of the new moon? Well, if you go back in Ezekiel to the 40th chapter, when the opening verses of this vision of Ezekiel's temple, the vision of the kingdom, you'll find in verse 1 and verse 2 some details that will tell you what day it was when Ezekiel got his vision. It turns out to be the 10th day of the beginning of their year, which on a Jewish calendar today is the month Tishri, the 7th month. Tell me, what was the 10th day of the 7th month every year in Jewish history from Moses forward? What was that date? The 10th day of the 7th month. What was that festival, that event? Day of Atonement, that's right. And I think what it's telling you in Ezekiel is that the Day of Atonement is finally coming to its fruition. The sacrifices of the Gospel Age are coming to their close, and now the blessing of the world is coming to its fruition because the kingdom is going to bring it, and this kingdom vision is given on the Day of Atonement. But there's something else about this vision, about the date. If you look at those first two verses, it'll tell you it began in the 30th year of some undefined cycle. Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 1 and 2 is going to tell you that it was the 30th year of some undefined vision. By Ezekiel chapter 40, when the temple vision begins, we're 20 years beyond that. In other words, we are now, when Ezekiel's vision was given, we are now in year 50, month 7, day number 10. Now, do you know what that marks? Year 50, day 10, month number 7. What starts on year 50? The Jubilee. He's telling us this is the fulfillment of the antitypical Jubilee, when mankind is going to get their life back again. And this is something I didn't know for many years, but at the Jubilee, if you go to Leviticus and see how it was calculated, you find out that you started out in the spring of the year counting months. By the time you got to the Jubilee, it's the autumn. But it's basically 48 and a half years full of months. And I learned this from a republication of a book by Brother Streeter that I was working on graphically. Turns out if you compute all this out, the Jubilee of Israel, according to the Jewish law, began, and I mean precisely, at the conclusion of 600 lunar months. Now, if you're interested in that, I'll give you all the details, but not here in the talk. But I calculated for you. It's very precise. The Jubilee comes at the end of 600 lunar months. So what is this scripture in Ezekiel telling us? That Ezekiel's vision, a vision about the established kingdom of Christ with respect to Israel, is after 600 moons. Is that kind of a parallel to the 6,000 years? Well, now, you remember yesterday, 2 days ago, we had something to say about the Noah's flood. And we said that when they looked out of the ark and they saw the water dried up from the earth, it was precisely the first day of the first month of a brand new year. Well, that's like when the tabernacle was built. The first day of a brand new month of a brand new year shows a new age in God's plan. So when the curse is dried from the earth, that's the beginning of a brand new age, the kingdom age, that is established at the end of this old world. But I didn't tell you at that time something that Genesis 8:13 says. It tells you more than just it's a brand new year. It tells you which year it was. It was the end of 600 years exactly to the day of Noah's count of years. I think that means the curse is lifted exactly at the end of 6,000 years. Or in terms of Israel, at the end of, symbolically, 600 lunations. 600 years, 600 lunations. One is giving you from the standpoint of Adam and his race. The other is giving you from the standpoint of Israel. So we got three testimonies here now. Three testimonies that the 6 days that are counting to the kingdom take us right to the threshold of the kingdom. One is Ezekiel 46:1. Those gates are closed until the 6 days are ended. Secondly, Noah's flood. The curse is dried at the end of, I think, in symbol, 6,000 years. Number three, Ezekiel, the Jubilee finally in its fullness comes at the end of 600 lunations, 6,000 years from Israel's point of view. Now, just a little side thought. When we talk about the Jubilees, it's about restoration. I actually think there are Jubilee pointers to 1874, to 1878, to 1948, and to the kingdom. So when I mention the Jubilee here, I'm focusing on the kingdom. But please don't misunderstand me to think that the Jubilees don't have other pointers as well. They do. That's all I'll say about that just here. Now, let's look at something that is in the reprints that doesn't get as much attention, perhaps, as I think it deserves. And this is reprint 2739. This is an article that was written in 1900. It was written in about November or December. And it was written in light of the fact that 14 years away, they were expecting the church to be complete. And so somebody wrote an article, a question. And this article is very brief. This article is very brief. It's only a question by a writer, and then Brother Russell's comment and answer to the question. And the question was, you say that 6,000 years have ended about 1872. Okay. Yeah, but then you say that something about 1878 and 1881, but you say then the Gentile times won't be over until 1915. You might have thought he'd say 1914, but it was 1915. And then, well, tell me exactly, clarify, when does the 1,000 years begin? That is the whole point of this article. And what the article says is, there's something about this question that we don't fully understand. Now, that's a different kind of answer than Brother Russell usually gave. Usually gave us his best opinion. But in this, he said, there's something about this we don't understand. And the reason we don't understand it is because God has not yet revealed it, because it's not yet time to understand. And I think that that answer is correct. I don't know of many people that really embrace that answer. But there it is, and a pointed answer to a direct question. But at the end of the article, he says this. He quotes Revelation 20, verse 4, verbatim. Doesn't cite it, but he quotes the words. And he says, this cannot begin until all the jewels are complete. But how do you resolve the issue? If 6,000 years have ended and we're in the seventh millennium, and the seventh millennium is Revelation, the 1,000 years of Revelation 20, verse 4, if that is right, well, then how can you have it not begin if the 6,000 years have already ended? But he says very expressly, it cannot begin till the jewels are complete. Now, if I was in the audience at this point, I'd say, yeah, I know. He said a lot of things. So I'll pull out another quote, something else. Do this for me. Find any reference you can that either quotes the words of Revelation 20, verse 4, or cites those numbers, Revelation 20, verse 4, anywhere in Brother Russell's writings, anywhere that cites those words or those numbers and applies that to 1874. If you can find such a quote, email it to me first. Please do. I've looked. I don't think it's there. And every case, I will claim, until debunked here, and every case, when he refers to that text or to the exact words of that text, he puts it future. Now, I could multiply quotations where he does put it future, many of them in his later years. But I won't, because you know that that's there. But maybe you haven't given sufficient attention to this particular direct answer to that question. Something missing here. I think what's missing is the extent of time, and that's explained by the fact that 6,000 years have not yet ended. Now, you can remember that article, even if you didn't jot it down. See that 27 and 39? How many books are in the New Testament? David? The New Testament. New Testament. 27. How many in the Old Testament? 39. I remember when I learned that, somebody told me that, and I've never forgotten it. Look at that article. Read it. See if that's credible. That's Brother Russell. Now, a few years later, reprint 3460, 1904. 4 years goes by, and you find a reprint article like none other. It has a chart, has a pair of charts. It's written by somebody else to Brother Russell, and he publishes it. And this is basically what it has. Two diagrams, one showing the 1,000 years beginning in 1874, and another with two periods of 2520 showing the 1,000 years beginning in 1914. And it's almost like you can see a sigh of relief. Okay, now we got the answer. If this is the answer to the conundrum that he discussed in reprint 2739, if it is, then what is the answer? The answer would be that the 1,000 years of Revelation 20, verse 4, would begin in 1914, because that's when all the jewels would be complete. And the other is an interesting 1,000 years, but it's not exactly Revelation 20, verse 4. That's the answer. What a refreshing answer. It solves the problem. You know, breathe a sigh of relief. Until, of course, 1914 comes and goes, and the church is not complete. And therefore, that answer is not suitable to the issue. But what it tells you is the question was still outstanding, and the issue is not yet resolved. Now, Brother Russell, as 1914 approached, he had some very, very wise words, which also deserve a lot of attention. I picked this up from Brother Charles Redeker of blessed memory, who's now gone, one of my disfavorite brethren. He quoted in one of his works on chronology at the very end, reprint 5348, which I think bears reading. A bad spirit is always objectionable and injurious. We should not denounce those who, in a proper spirit, express their dissent in respect to the date 1914, which they were looking forward to soon, about a year from this article. Nor should we feel aggrieved toward them. We should recognize the individual rights of all and treat everybody according to the golden rule. Nor should we feel, and I'll apply this to myself, nor should we feel at liberty to express our views more dogmatically than we would think right for others to do in expressing their views. We must admit there are possibilities of our having made a mistake in respect to the chronology, even though we do not see where a mistake has been made. Very wise words, if these words had been applied from the pen of a faithful servant for the last 60 years, might the history among us have been a little bit modified, perhaps. And I will include me in that, among those that could have been better benefited by them. Now, we're going to go a little further, and we're going to show something else about Brother Russell that may surprise you concerning these issues. We're going to skip to this. This is what I think should be the solution for the issues that have been among us and for why the kingdom is delayed. And that is that there are 7 days for the church on one scale and 7 larger days for the world on the other scale. These 2 scales are not the same, and they mesh so that the 7th church ends at the beginning of the 7th millennium for the world. If that is the right solution, then it answers all the problems. It embraces reprint 2739. The 1,000 years of Revelation 20 won't begin until all the jewels are complete. It answers all the problems. It's just simply a matter of the count of years. But you say, now wait a minute. How sure are we about that count of years? I mean, the speaker seems very sure of it, but how sure can we be? Well, let me simplify it and repeat what we said before. It depends upon 2 things. Is that generally accepted date today, 966 BC, right, or is it not? If it's not, then it's false. But if it is, the only other thing it depends on is the Hebrew Old Testament. That's it. If you count the years from the Hebrew Old Testament, from Adam to Solomon, it is unambiguous. It will take you to 6,000 years ending a couple of decades from now. That's all it depends on. Now, you've probably heard me give presentations more detailed and try to count the numbers and try to show that, okay, I'd love to do that. Got a few hours? No, okay. But I won't. I just want to show you that it's not that complex. It's not a choice between 10 choices. It's a choice that's unified to one. If you use Brother Russell's approach, a commonly accepted date that is well-grounded, and you add to that the Hebrew history from the Old Testament, you've got the kingdom, the end of 6,000 years, about a generation from today. But now we want to show something further based on this. What does that mean with respect to Brother Russell? That seems an odd question, but let's see. First of all, before we get there, pardon me, this is what it means to the unfolding of 7,000 years. Do you see 7,000 years is still intact? We've got 3,500 years and another 3,500. But do you see what happens right in the middle of that 7,000 years? Exactly in the middle of that time, coincidentally, begins the prophecy of 70 weeks of Daniel chapter 9 leading to the atonement. Now, I remember where I was and what I was doing when that thought came, when I realized that. I always carry my calculator around and, you know, checking this and checking that. I said, what's the middle of 7,000 years if this is right? I was stunned, and I'm stunned still in retrospect to this day. It was exactly the date beginning the count of years towards the redemption. Is that coincidence? Is that fortuitous? Or is there meaning here? That the first 3,500, the nighttime, as it were, of this day, was in darkness, and now light begins to dawn. You remember what Habakkuk 3:2 says? In the midst of the years, in wrath, remember mercy. And that's what happened. In the midst of God's plan of 7,000 years, while wrath is being poured out upon all flesh, he remembers mercy and begins to count the days toward the redemption, and then the first stage of redemption, and then the second stage of redemption. It is exactly halfway when that count of years begins. Next, Jeremiah Pastor Russell. If those years that we're suggesting are right, then they map out this way. And you can find the 40 years that Jeremiah served in his ministry. It just turned out to be 40 years. You know that because Jeremiah tells you it was the 13th year of Josiah when he began his ministry. And, you know, he ended with the collapse of Jerusalem. And it was 40 years. Interesting period of time. It just so happens that if you allocate that 40 years properly in the first 2,500-year period, and then you find the corresponding 40-year period in the next 2,500 years, it exactly hits 1874 to 1914, the 40-year service of Pastor Russell before the time of trouble began. Now, there's more to this parallel, but I hope it doesn't escape you the stunning nature of this result. The years counting of 6,000 years, if what we're suggesting is right, is not arbitrary. It's not subject to manipulation. You take the generally accepted date, add the Hebrew Old Testament. That's it. When you do that, you get this result. Jeremiah and Pastor Russell are put in parallel to each other. You remember in Ezekiel, the 9th chapter, a scripture we always apply, usually apply to Pastor Russell, the man with the writer's inkhorn. It was Brother Tom Ruggerillo gave a talk in Chicago a few years ago. It really attracted my attention. When he says, yes, that's Pastor Russell. But initially, in the days of the prophet, the person who did that work for literal Israel was Jeremiah. Jeremiah is literally the person with the man writer's inkhorn that marked the Israelites aside and cried for the abominations of Jerusalem. That spiritually is, in spiritual Christendom, Pastor Russell. How is it feasible that when you actually get what I think is the right count of years, that's unambiguous, it's not subject to manipulation, that two things pop out? The 70 weeks begins right at the middle, in wrath, remember mercy. And second, the very servant of God that has used to give us clarity in the divine plan is marked so pointedly as the man with the writer's inkhorn in a pointed numerical way that you know appeals to me, and I hope appeals to you. Okay, well, where can we go from here? If you extend that, you also find a pointer to Israel's restoration in 1948. But I'll pass by that for right now. Yes, the last point. You see that messianic age at the end? Do you know that that's not the way the chart usually read for most of Pastor Russell's ministry? It was the term millennial age, and now it's messianic age. When did that change come? It came in 1913. My suggestion? That in 1913, Pastor Russell realized, thinking deeply about all these issues, you know, Revelation 20, verse 4 has not yet begun. It won't begin till the church is complete. I better change that to a broader term, not millennial age, but messianic, because I've got this starting with the Lord's return in 1874. And if that's not where the 1,000 years began, I better change that word. Now, that's my suggestion for his motivation. Whatever it was, the facts are that in 1913, he did change that designation. I didn't find that. It was Brother George Tabak. But I think he's correct in this. We have to summarize and then conclude. In summary, the hope that we have all embraced for so long is near. As Brother Hudson would have said, it didn't happen, but it will. I give it 25 years. I think we're back to that point. I think we have some precision. This is interpretation. The whole concept of 7,000 years. Interpreting Ezekiel 46:1, that those gates are still shut, it's interpretation. You be the judge for whether this is reasonable interpretation and whether this might be the answer. But if Brother Russell said in 2739, there's something veiled because the Lord hasn't revealed it, because it's not yet time, do you think it would have been timely for the saints to have known at the Lord's return that it would be over a century and a half before their hopes were realized? Would that have helped them? I don't think so. Today, is it helpful to know that we have a single generation to go? I think so. It tells us we're on the precipice, on the verge of the most glorious time that we have been expecting for all these years. Keep faithful. Keep devoted. Press on like Elijah would have.